Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are...
Men.
Men. Glad we were on the same page.
Well, yeah, we're just two faces on the same eldritch entity. Why wouldn't we be? We're never out
we,
of step.
We are man. The subject of today's episode, as you may have intuited, is the Alex Garland film Men. And it's an odd one.
Yeah, it was divisive in the film going, not just me, like general audiences. I seldom care about that sort of thing, especially when a movie is this off-putting, you know? I mean, it's designed to get like an F cinema score, like
right,
in a lab, practically, because it's just violent and confounding and political. It's everything that moviegoers don't want, basically. But even in
Film Twitter.
Yeah. It's been something of a punching bag. So I went into it expecting it to not fully stick the landing, and also having heard whisperings to the effect of, well, it's got a really balls to the wall third act. So I was anticipating that the whole time, the whole preamble, first two thirds of the movie. And that was pleasurable for me up to a point. And there's good stuff in here. I don't know what, if anything, it all amounts to, but
yeah,
some of that has got to be post-break business.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. So, yeah, the film starts with a woman named Harper, played by Jesse Buckley, whose husband has recently committed suicide, it seems. We get more details as we go on, sort of sprinkled throughout the film. And she has taken herself off to this country estate to get some alone time and recuperate. And she has just a series of gradually more unsettling encounters with strange male village folk who are all Rory Kinnear, as you may have seen from the trailer. It's kind of hard to miss, really, if you have.
Yeah, well, you see the title, first of all, you know, Alex Garland, A24 horror movie, Men. And you think, okay, this is going to be sort of a Jordan Peele pastiche. Maybe. He's always got those punchy titles, whether it's Nope or Us, you know, Men. And it's loaded. It's to do with some kind of soapbox, you suspect. So I was expecting something more in that vein, something with a message. Indeed, it may be. But then what?
But the message is impenetrable.
What do I know? I just saw the movie. But what got me more stoked for it than that was when I first started hearing murmurings about how it's a folk horror piece, and I'm all about that. And folk horror can mean a lot of things to a lot of people, but what it really means is it's a little bit like The Wicker Man. And I'm going to talk more about this as we go along, but this movie kind of does almost exactly the bare minimum to be considered a folk horror movie, and that wound up bothering me more than the thematic and political murkiness and the general impenetrability of it. I thought there are nominal attempts to make you feel like you're watching something that's like The Wicker Man, but it felt very incidental to me. And if there were one thing that I could change, I would ramp that up a great deal, that element. And that's true of most movies, in fairness, but this movie is a little bit more of a cock tease about it. So we open with Harper, I believe is her name.
Yes.
Already. Okay. Let's cards on the table, gentlemen. I've retained Harper's name, and I've retained the name of one of the Rorys, and the rest I'll be referring
the
to.
The landlord,
yeah,
one? Well, yeah, yeah, that's the name that really, that's the only one that matters.
Right, so we're in good shape. Well, actually, I should probably, what is her late husband's name? Do we remember that?
James, maybe? That sounds right.
Good enough. So Harper shows up to this country house that she's going to be staying in for a period of some months as she heals and mourns her late husband who killed himself. We see this in the opening scene. In fact, it's a little odd. He falls in slow motion past a window and they make eye contact through the window pane. And I believe a Fleetwood Mac song is playing over this, or it sounded like Stevie Nicks. I don't know exactly what it was, but the falling and the slow-mo reminded me of Antichrist, but everything else was not that hardcore yet. I mean, Antichrist kicks off with some real hostility, some really hard to handle imagery, and this movie,
and also a dong.
Yeah, right. Which this movie eventually supplies, yes. But it's not. It doesn't give you the Bad Lieutenant special right off the bat.
No.
It doesn't come out guns blazing quite that same way. So Harper shows up at this house in the country and is met at the door by Nigel Thornberry.
Yes.
It's the first of the Rory Kinnears to which we're introduced. His name is Jeffrey, and he's like if the phrase Bob's your uncle was a man. he's just pip chip. He's just pip pip cheerio about anything and everything. And actually, me Porky Pigging just there was actually a halfway decent impersonation of him. He's constantly growling and murmuring, muttering. It's like he keeps talking and forgets to open his mouth. Or maybe he just can't part his enormous British teeth all the way.
He's impossibly British. Or as Harper puts it later on FaceTime with her friend Riley, I believe is her name. Very country.
Yeah. At one point, he indicates a closet. He calls it like the cloak room. And I think he says that that's where she can stow her frillies and willies or something like that.
Wellies. Is like Wellingtons.
Oh,
like,
yeah. Like,
you know, big rubber boots.
Sure.
For tromping around in the marshlands or whatever.
He could have
it's
said,
a series of things that rhymes with wellies. I mean, it probably would have sounded a little bit like gibberish even to an Englishman, but to us, it's just utter fucking nonsense.
Yeah, he's speaking Klingon, basically, at that point. And he does not, this Jeffrey character, does not lay on the menace the way you would expect him to, given what I had seen of this movie's reputation, which is that it was, like, terrifically unsubtle and just in your face, basically. A lot of horror movies these days, some made by women, some made by men, but it's very in vogue to have a, like, male antagonist with, like, zero redeeming qualities. And sometimes that works. Like, I like the Invisible Man in the most recent Invisible Man movie.
Yeah.
He's frightening. Other movies, it bothered me because I thought that they were so thinly characterized that it just felt a little facile. Well, like, I think I made that complaint of Swallow when we watched it,
yeah.
Even though Swallow is generally pretty good.
Yeah, Jeffrey's just a little bit boorish and a little bit clueless.
Yeah, he's just kind of a kook. I mean, the worst thing that at one point he makes a kind of weird remark about how she shouldn't flush tampons down the toilet at one point because it's a septic tank situation. And then he tactlessly asks, you know, where's hubby? And she has to indicate that she's separated, but doesn't get into any of the baggage.
Death. Yeah.
Right. Even after that, he kind of admonishes himself, you know, for putting his foot in it.
Well done, Jeffrey.
He's like, talks like Churchill with a mouthful of marbles.
So Churchill.
Yeah, right. So after he leaves, Harper gets on the phone with her friend, Riley, and the two of them are FaceTiming. Nothing much comes of that. I mean, they commiserate a little bit, and Harper, you know, gripes about Jeffrey being a kook. But then it's interrupted, the call is, by, it's really strange. It gets all pixelated, and then there's like a man's screaming face jumbled up in the pixel distortion.
Yeah, briefly.
And it's a blink and you miss it thing, which I would have liked were it not for the fact that you can hear a tinny little, like, which is like, it's like a jump scare with the volume turned way down. It's like,
right.
It's subtle, but also very much not subtle at all. And I thought that it was too much too soon. It would have been worse to have an actual jump scare in the Conjuring sense, you know, like a ta-dun.
Yeah, like a close-up of Riley on FaceTime, so this jump scare would take up the whole screen.
Right.
And they're like, ah!
And then
a hand
reaches out or something.
Well, that would have been a bridge even further.
Yes.
But yeah, something of that ilk.
So I'm going to try not to get hung up on every little... You know, you go into a movie like this that has its defenders and also its detractors, and you're kind of always waiting for the other shoe to drop. So I, at least on a scene-by-scene basis, was like, okay, is this the moment where the movie is going to lose me? And there's not a simple answer to that question. It didn't just, I didn't feel myself like fall off the hook decisively at any point, even well into the end game. But it was little moments like this that kind of gave me pause. It wasn't, in other words, like a Last Night in Soho situation where I was like, oh, never mind.
Oh, no. But Matt, this is what you wanted.
Is it? So Harper goes for a walk and finds a echoey dark tunnel into which she does this kind of sing-song, you know, ah, 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 ah. This is in the trailer, and it bounces back at her. And it's a cool scene. She gets this whole symphonic kind of a cappella thing going.
She layers her own echoes.
Mm-hmm. As she's proceeding deeper into the tunnel. She's about the halfway point when she sees a silhouetted figure sort of hunkered down at the other mouth of the tunnel.
Presumably male.
Mm-hmm. Men. Yes. He stands up, and does he break into a run right away, or does he...
Not quite right away, but pretty quickly. And it's like, it's also not quite a run. It's not like a full-out charge, but he just starts kind of loping towards her.
Uh-huh. And this is accompanied by, whether it's diegetic or not is anyone's guess, but because she's been producing these echoes for a couple minutes now, the soundtrack then takes that up, that motif, and makes kind of creepy, less like singing, more like screaming kind of echoes bounce off the walls of this tunnel. And to me, it's eerie because it feels like a two-way street. So far, the tunnel has just been regurgitating what she's been giving it, but now the tunnel is like telling her the noises she's going to be making momentarily if this guy catches up with her. That was the implication I took from it anyway. I think it's probably the most effective scare moment in the whole movie. Not like jump out of your seat scary, but unnerving. So she hightails it out of there and clambers through some brush. And as she's walking across a field, thinking that she's in the clear, she sees what I basically took to be the monster from It Follows off in the distance behind her. It's just a naked man, buck-ass nude.
A naked Rory Kinnear.
Yeah.
If that didn't go without saying.
And he's just, you know, standing there. I mean, statuesque stillness. And she puts some distance between him and herself and goes back to the country house. These scenes are interspersed with cutaways to her marriage, which was abusive, you know, very fraught. The first time we see the husband via flashback, the two of them are just yelling at one another. He's threatening to kill himself. So he's, you know,
She divorces him.
Yeah, if she
leaves
him.
I'm pretty sure this is all just one. I mean, it's the day he killed himself. It's not like going through their whole relationship.
No, you're right. It's not like a scenes from a marriage thing. It is where things culminated. He hits her. This is not all the same flashback, but as you say, it's all from the same episode in their marriage, in their life. She cusses him out and tells him to get lost. And then he throws himself out a window, or maybe slips and falls while trying to gain entry to her apartment
or their
apartment.
Forced himself into the apartment directly above them upstairs. And yeah, he either jumped from that balcony or was trying to climb down from that balcony to theirs and slipped, or maybe somewhere between the two. It's not clear to her or us.
Again, not all the same flashback, but shortly we see the condition of his body where he landed, and his arm has been sliced up the middle by a point on a wrought iron fence. He landed on a fence and partially impaled himself, but not like a clean movie impalement of the kind that you see most of the time in horror movies, whether it's like how the crazy lady gets off at the end of Hand That Rocks the Cradle or something like that, where, you know, you land on a white picket fence and invariably it's just like, woo, right through the gut, you know?
Right.
Not so this time. It's messy and just inelegant. It's kind of a strange word to use, but it looks like an accident. It looks like a crime scene.
Mm-hmm.
Not a convenient one either. Harper gets on the horn with her friend again the following day, I think, and the two of them are FaceTiming once again, and the friend is getting Harper to give her the grand tour. So Harper's going from room to room. Here's the kitchen, here's the such and such, and
here's
all the while,
wellies and jellies and bellies room.
And the flingers and flangers.
Bangers and mash, bubbles and squeak. Haggis! don't know what Nick Cage movie that is. It's just in that fucking compilation.
Uh-huh.
YouTube.
Yeah, it's burned into my brain too. Foundational stuff. All the while, the naked nutter from before is poking around and peering through the windows at her, and she doesn't see him.
For a good long stretch.
For a good long stretch, and then she does see him. I'm going to call you back. And she proceeds to call the cops. And I was surprised because it's a woman's voice on the other end when she calls, is it 999?
Yeah, in the UK, I believe that's what it is.
You know, there's someone stalking me and trying to break into my house. And a hand, there's battering on the front door, and then he sticks his hand through the mail slot and startles her quite badly. And then the cops show up, and what you and I were both expecting was for there to be nobody neither there. Hide nor hair of him.
Yeah, he just evaporated.
And for some condescending male cop to be like, you sure you're not seeing things, love? Gave yourself a fright, did you? You know, that kind of garbage.
Pop it.
But no, they cuff the guy right there on the lawn, and they drape a coat over him. Harper has her only face-to-face interaction with a woman in the whole film, I believe, not counting FaceTime.
To FaceTime.
Yeah. And the woman cop basically indicates, oh, he's probably harmless, but he smells bad, and he's been sleeping rough. He's an imposing figure, I should add, not just because he's naked and antagonizing the main character, but also because he's covered in cuts and abrasions that look a little too hardcore to just be him crawling through brambles or something.
Right.
You know, it looks like he's been fucking himself up for unknown and possibly occult reasons.
Well, he's got, like, his skin is kind of jaundiced looking. Mm-hmm. It's kind of yellowy, greeny. Yeah, it's just very weird.
So they cart him off. Harper goes to the local church, and possibly occult scratches on the naked guy notwithstanding, because you have to really read between the lines to see. You know, I'm just a huge kill list guy, which is the only reason I'm, you know, my ears perk up when I'd be like, oh, could it be, you know, could right. those scratches have, well, it's like the blood on the side of the van in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you know, where it looks, where the hitchhiker cuts his palm and then it looks like he's trying to write something on the door as it's driving off. And then later on, I think Franklin, the guy in the wheelchair, is like, do you think it means something? And the other, you know, his sister's friends all give him shit for it, but it's like, well, what if it does mean something, you know? I'm always on the lookout for stuff like that. But that notwithstanding, this is when the movie first plays its folk horror card, and it does so in the form of this weird altar in the middle of the church that just has this Wicker Man ass face on it.
Yep.
This green man kind of pagan nature god face. And we again get the, like, ha ha. Well, that sounded like fucking the bully from The Simpsons. <That's>... Now, the echoey tunnel music motif coming yeah. back again. On the other side of the altar, there's a, oh, hell. There's like a Celtic fetish object. It's like a Sheenaga something or other. Just trampling it, of course. But it's a fertility thing. That it's spreading its vagina lips apart, this strange figure on the other side of the altar. Not the kind of thing that you would expect to see in a quaint little
Anglican church.
Yeah, right. So Harper is sitting in one of the pews and having an emotional breakdown, is kind of screaming. Again, I think this is being intercut with some of the flashback business with the husband and his demise. So she walks out of the church and has a puzzling interaction with a boy
who has a CGI Rory Kinnear face.
A bad, yeah, it's a real Benjamin Buttoning kind of effect. Well, first he's got this plastic, almost like Marilyn Monroe.
I think,
like,
that's exactly what it's supposed to be. Yeah. You know, very stylized, like cartoony sort of. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Marilyn Monroe plastic mask, and he yeah, lifts it up, like, and it's fucking a shrunken Rory Kinnear face on yeah, a child size head.
Looks like it, like if Polar Express animation was an illness that you could contract, he would have like stage 2 Polar Express disorder. It's not terminal yet, but he's not looking too good.
Which, since it's supposed to be uncanny, is not a problem, but it does look powerfully weird.
Yeah. Well, you understand why he goes around with the Marilyn Monroe mask on, if nothing else, because that's right. easier to look at. So he is just a real oddball and says something about wanting to play hide and seek, and she declines that invitation, and he calls her a bitch or whatever, and then stomps off.
Bitch.
Yeah, a stupid bitch, and then he stomps off after being told to do so by a priest, also
the vicar.
Yeah, the vicar, also wouldn't you know, played by Rory Kinnear, who initially is a more sympathetic figure, and then not so much. He tries to give her spiritual counseling. She opens up a little bit about her marriage, and then he
you must wonder why you drove him to suicide. You castrating bitch. You succubus.
he stops just short of laying
calling her names.
Yeah, just as much as the boy did. He also rests a hand on her thigh in a way that's most unwelcome.
Well, I was expecting that to, number one, escalate on a direct physical level, and it never does at that point.
Uh-huh.
And or have Harper be like, the fuck, dude. And she gives like the slightest glance down to the hand, but then basically lets it go.
Mm-hmm.
So it didn't play out really the way I expected it to.
Yeah, she doesn't turn on him until he gives her the guilt trip, at which point she wants nothing to do with him, understandably.
Tells him to fuck off and immediately leaves.
And then after she leaves, there's a shot of him creepily applying chapstick. Kind of licking his lips like a lizard.
And fondling the space on the bench where she had been sitting.
Harper goes down to the pub and is just surrounded by Rorys on all sides. One of which is Jeffrey, the landlord. And he asks her how she's settling in. And he learns, not from her, but from, I think, a cop who comes in.
The one who cuffed the naked guy. And wouldn't you know it, yet again. Rory Kinnear.
Yeah. Landlord Jeffrey learns from the cop that they had this attempted break-in situation. And then Harper learns from the cop that they had to let the guy go because it's not like he stole anything. And she says, but he was stalking me. He followed me out of the woods. And the cop...
He tried to break in.
Yeah, you know. kind of writes her off and says, well, if you see him again, give us a ring.
Give us a shout.
She calls them a bunch of wankers or something under her breath as she gets the fuck out of there. So she goes back to the house. We get one last FaceTime with the friend. Harper has, unusually for a character in a movie like this, announced, to hell with this, I'm just getting out of here. After much less provocation than the person would get in the average horror movie. You know?
Right.
Usually there'd be a dead pet or something by this point, or clear evidence of a haunting. But she's just not feeling it anymore, and she's ready to drive home, a good 3-4 hour drive. The friend says, no, I'll come to you.
Fuck that. They're not taking this away from you, etc.
Right. This is your healing journey, whatever. So sit tight. I'll be there in however many hours, 3-4 hours. And as Harper tries to give her directions, their call keeps getting interrupted, and I'm sure there was a dude's face mixed up in the pixels somewhere. I just expected there to be at this point, as the but no tinny screaming this time around. So it feels like kind of lopsided that way a little. You know, we always say cart before the horse. It's one of our most persistent brain worms on this.
Yeah,
podcast.
Although usually we're talking about ourselves.
Ourselves. So she calls back once or twice and the call keeps getting dropped. So she tries to text her directions, and then the texts that she gets back are very out of character for Riley. Is that her name?
Yeah.
And you know,
it's like it's Kid Rory.
Yes, it's all caps. And that alone was, my nerves were frayed enough by this point that just getting the all caps messages in response was like, stop shouting at me. You know, I thought you were on my side. And then one of them, the last text goes, you stupid bitch. I don't know what to make of that exactly. And that's the case from here on out, because what happens next is there's another attempted break, and it looks like there's going to be a Straw Dogs situation with like all the Rorys descending on the house. I think the cop is on the lawn, and then some other guy charges at the front door, which she slams just in the nick of time.
Yeah, one of the bar patrons who we never actually hear talking.
And then something gets thrown through the window in the kitchen, and then there's battering upon the front door once again, and she's got a knife. She's threatening to use it. And good old Jeffrey opens the front door.
Hey, what's all this then?
She explains the situation to him. He is still not doing the heel turn that you expect, although there's so clearly a conspiracy against her at this point that you just, I mean, he's got the right face. He's part of it. He has to be. So it's a little weird that he's still just trustworthy Jeffrey. And that's not just me finding the character kind of affable and fun to be around. She also seems to.
It's very much an, oh, Jeffrey, thank God.
Yes, yeah. Right. On her end.
Yeah.
So what came through the window of the kitchen was a crow. Or a sparrow or something, which has badly injured itself. So he goes in and breaks its neck. Although at that point, I was just expecting him to bite its head off like Ozzy Osbourne. You know, very little would have surprised me at this point, I thought.
Right.
And then the movie proceeded to do what it's about to do.
So he takes it upon himself like, well, I'm your landlord. I'm going to take a walk around the grounds and try and find whoever might have done this and give them what for. And he does this, and there's been...
Like, challenge them to a duel, probably.
Basically. There's been a couple instances of auto lights blinking on and off, you know, that classic trope. It happens with the cop. He disappears that way. And... lights shut off. She calls out Jeffrey, and then he just, you know, waves his hands and wakes up the lights again. But after announcing, like, well, it looks like they might run off. Poof.
Yeah, the lights go out, and when they come back on, Jeffrey is nowhere to be seen. And that was kind of... So here's how the scene plays out. Jeffrey is really pushing his luck. He's going around the whole house and the grounds going, are you there? Come out! You know, let's... All right, I don't know what this is all about, but, you know, shove off, be gone with you, you know, on and on and on. And in any other movie, he'd be a total goner. He would turn around and say, looks like the coast is clear, love, and then get a tomahawk to the head or something. But you know that it's Rory Kinnear, and you just get the sense that the entity, whatever it is not going to harm itself. So right. He's going to be fine. It's good that it's not predictable, like, oh, he's just going to get offed. It's good that that's not a foregone conclusion, but it's almost like it has the opposite problem, this sequence. Like, he's in no danger because you know that he's just one head on the Hydra, whatever this thing is.
Yeah.
So, anyway, now the movie kind of shifts into another gear. And from here on out, you don't have time to get hung up on particulars of this or that. It's all just kind of a big weird wave that crashes over you. What is it? It's
so the woodsman, the naked green man,
right,
shows up, and he is
getting greener by the day.
Yes, he basically now has a plant face.
There was a scene earlier, a random cutaway to him where he slits his forehead open and creates a kind of
pocket,
flesh pocket in his forehead, and he starts tucking a leaf into it, and he has proceeded to do that with a variety of leaves and twigs and so on.
So now he's got kind of a face like the Wicker Man face on the altar. He approaches, and all of a sudden his belly starts... Well, no, I'm getting ahead of myself.
The movie's a bit of a jumble after this point.
At some point before this, one of the Rorys is pounding on the door. I think it is him, and I just fused two scenes with the same version of Rory together.
Understandable.
He sticks his arm through the mail slot, but it's less aggressive, at least at first this time. It's sort of like a beckoning, like, I've got my hand out, come with me.
Yes, come hither.
And she sort of reaches out, puts her hand in his, and then... You know, he clamps down and starts pulling on her. And that's when she stabs him straight through the forearm with her kitchen knife.
Mm-hmm. He tries to withdraw his arm, and the knife gets stuck on the mail slot. And
rather than turning it or sticking his other hand through to pull it out and then pull out both arms, he just pulls the knife through his entire forearm and then his hand.
Yeah, he just vivisects his arm practically from the elbow down, like through the webbing between two of his fingers, gives himself this... Yeah,
between the middle and ring finger.
Yeah, he gives himself like...
Spocks himself.
He permanently spocks himself, that's right. And for the rest of the movie, all of the Rorys have that kind of floppy crab claw going on. The next one we see is the kid, who's like, you hurt me, and then challenges her to another game of hide and seek.
She's like, I'll cut you. What, are you going to hurt me again? I don't think so.
Yeah, he advances on her when she says that. And it's kind of the corniest moment in the whole movie, or at least I expected it to be, because the knife point comes to rest on his chest because she's kind of backing away from him as he's advancing on her. Thankfully, because what I thought was going to happen was that she was going to stand her ground and he was just going to walk into the knife in like a power move, mm-hmm. like the fucking opening scene of Van Helsing. You can't kill me, Victor. I'm already dead. You know, which, you know, is good in Van Helsing, maybe not so much here.
In Men, no, probably yeah. not. So Harper gets to the bathroom upstairs, and the priest appears. So, you know, she closes the door behind her and latches it or whatever, but just somehow he gets the latch open and comes in and just gives a long, long, thirsty speech.
Yeah, it gets real wordy, this part of the climax, and he just goes full Frollo. He's like, you witch, you put these amorous thoughts in my head. It's all your fault that I got the first hard-on of my life at 44. It's what have you done to me? And she winds up stabbing him, and it's framed as this sexual penetration. He has this, like, amorous kind of grunt, sigh thing. Right after she guts him, and then he staggers off.
This is after he has used both halves of his crab claw to grab her on, like, both shoulders at the same time.
Yeah, that I liked just because the two halves of his hand kind of alight spider-like on her shoulders, you know, in a way that gave me the heebie-jeebies with the gory, vivisected part of his arm just kind of resting on her throat. I thought the whole way through this climax up until the big stunt, which we're just about to get to, I was thinking all the way through, like, yeah, I mean, the hand thing is pretty gnarly, but that can't be the only thing in your bag of tricks, you know?
It was not.
Yeah, I mean, he milks it for all it's worth, and then we get the piece de resistance in the form of the green man coming back with child. He's got a big distended belly, and he proceeds to give birth to...
Well, you're jumping the gun a little bit.
Oh.
She runs for the car first.
Oh, yes.
And drives away and makes a series of sharp turns and eventually plows into Jeffrey standing in the middle of the road. And even now, she's like, oh, no, Jeffrey.
Yeah, not Jeffrey.
Like, she's about to get out of the car and then she sees him get up and we see that he, too, has crab hand. And we're like, okay, well, that's final complete confirmation that he is one of the heads on the Hydra.
If confirmation were needed.
Right. He's one of many Rorys as opposed to an independent Rory. And he drags her out of the car and drives off.
Yeah, and that's his belated heel turn. And it's weird because it is just a carjacking. He just pulls her out of the automobile and then speeds off in her blue Honda Civic or whatever it is. It's a Ford Fiesta, actually. Yeah.
And as aggressive as he is, like, dragging her out of the car and saying, Mrs. Marlowe, when he kept calling her Ms. after she corrected him early on.
Uh-huh.
He's still only a little bit of a bad guy in this scene simply because she did just hit him with the car at speed.
Right.
Like, it's a carjacking, but only kind of, so because he was hit by a car.
So he takes off into the night, and then she looks up into the night sky, which is now full of these kind of bright white pinprick stars, like this, you know, this starry array. The movie goes full cosmic horror for like 20 seconds. The camera pans up into the night sky, and we get this like, and then the camera pans back down. You swerve suddenly from Lovecraft to like Death Proof as the car's headlights reemerge into frame and her car is just gunning it for her. And she runs back into the house and the car crashes into some stone pillars out on the front lawn and comes to a stop. It's the minute of screen time that I think is most indicative of how Alex Garland is kind of just throwing shit at a wall and kind of trying to do everything at once. It's cosmic horror, but it's also Christine. Waiter, let that breathe, you know, just give it some time to let us ruminate on it. I don't know. So anyway, now we get to the stunt, the big stunt that I alluded to before.
Oh boy.
The Green Man. It's a succession of Rorys birthing
Rorys.
An endless parade of Rorys, yeah, who just get slimier and more coated in bloody afterbirth. And they don't, it's not, I mean, it's sort of a Russian nesting doll situation, but they don't all come slithering out in the order you'd expect. I think the kid Rory is the second one, and then he has to birth a full-grown man, so you do the math.
One comes like out of a mangina in the place you would think to find one, and then there's one on Kid Rory's back, and then another one comes out of the previous Rory's chest, and then finally Jeffrey Rory is stumbling around in the entryway to the house, kind of crawling after her as she's backing away, and she gets into the kitchen. And he's propped up in the doorway, and I'm a little bit pleased with myself that I predicted exactly what form this would take. Well, not exactly. I didn't know what part was going to come out first. You said but it came out of the mouth.
You said it kind of derisively. You were like, what, the mouth next? And then that's exactly what happened.
2 feet
yeah.
come out of the mouth, and finally, it is not a Rory. It is Harper's husband.
Right.
And for whatever reason, it only just dawned on me, like, oh, right. The arms are like his arm after hitting the fence. I don't know. My brain is porridge, I guess. It didn't occur to me until this moment. But yeah, his ankle's broken. His arm is bisected, just like happened to him after he jumped off or fell off the balcony.
Yeah. So all of the men have accumulated these injuries over the course of the night as they've been doing battle with Harper. I guess the ankle got fucked up in the car collision, probably. I think that's the first time you see one of the little Rorys, like hobbling around on the, like, stubby ankle bone.
Right. So Harper and her dead husband kind of have it out here. What do you want, James, or whatever the hell his name is? It comes down to your love. That's what I want. And she just kind of says, like, yeah. Smash cut, men.
Yeah, title drop. And roll credits? No, in fact. We get a little, thankfully, because I would not have been at all happy with that. And really, I have misgivings about this, too, but it's better than if that was all she wrote. Here, we get a little denouement where the friend shows up, having driven through the night, finds the car crashed on the front lawn and blood in the entryway. Just a real state of affairs, a whole situation. And then she sees Harper alive and well, and indeed, I think, physically unscathed. I'll say that for this movie. Its gender politics are a little bit inscrutable, but it at least doesn't. It's very unlike the overwhelming majority of horror movies in that the woman in peril is not physically brutalized at all. Doesn't have so much as a skinned knee, as right. far as I know.
Just someone else's blood.
Yeah. So Harper's sitting in the backyard and looks up and smiles at her friend, and then we roll credits.
More after the break.
Something happened. My husband went upstairs to our balcony and let himself go.
You must wonder why you drove him to it.
Why? I didn't drive him to it.
I think it'd be true. But if you'd given him the chance to apologize, he'd still be alive.
What?
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at ShockDoctorsPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ShockDoctorsPod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. Podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
A man followed me out of the woods. He was stalking me.
What makes you say that?
I saw him twice.
twice. I don't know if he saw you once.
Want to play a game? You hide, I'll see.
You must feel an awful sense of guilt.
Stay away from me.
And we're back. So, I don't know. What do you make of Men,
Matt? I think... All right. So, I'm a big fan of Annihilation. I liked Ex Machina a good deal, too. More than a little. I mean, I wasn't euphoric about it the way some people were. But I am fairly euphoric about Annihilation. So, are those his only two features prior to this?
That he directed...
I know he's a screenwriter,
He's been a screenwriter for a while. Wrote... Yeah. A few Danny Boyle movies, mm-hmm. Sunshine.
I like that one a lot. I think he did 28 Days Later, too, possibly.
But. Yeah, basically, Alex Garland's filmography as both a writer and a director is broadly rather good.
Yeah.
Some better than others, obviously, like anyone, but generally quite good. And, I mean, I would say Men is also not bad, but it's definitely kind of the biggest crapshoot, at least out of the ones I've seen.
Yeah, definitely. And I think I had sort of a minor epiphany watching it, which is that the three films that he's directed that I've seen all pose the same question, which is it human or isn't it? It's true of the robots in Ex Machina, and that's in a fairly run-of-the-mill sci-fi way, which is like, would they pass the Turing test? Is it, you know, it's the Blade Runner question, you know? Yeah. Does it have a soul? Is it basically the same as you or me after it meets a certain degree of sophistication? And then in Annihilation, the question is the Oscar Isaac who came out of the bad place the same Oscar Isaac who went in?
Or is it an eldritch abomination?
Right. Or is it a little of both? It's like, what is identity? And in both of those movies, it's TBD. You're still not sure at the end of the day whether the robots or the human beings who go into the Shimmer, I think it's called, whether they're as human as you are when the credits roll. It gives you something to ponder. Here, the answer has never been more decisive. It's like it's just demonic. At first, there's that uncanny valley effect where you meet one Rory Kinnear and then another Rory Kinnear and then another and another, and you're sort of waiting for the other shoe to drop. And once that shoe drops, it's like it's so out of pocket that it totally loses that feeling of uncertainty, that eerie kind of feeling that you got from Ex Machina and certainly from Annihilation. And I think that's where he drops the ball for me. That and the failure to rise to the occasion on the folk horror front.
Right.
As I said, that amounted to not much more than just posturing for me.
Yeah, on the folk horror front, I mean, yeah, okay, he's got the naked Rory that puts plant shit on his face or whatever. But honestly, that reminded me less of folk horror and more of Tessa Thompson in Annihilation.
Mm.
When, spoilers, but she gets grown through with plants.
Right.
And yeah, it really just mostly reminded me of that. The only thing that was sort of indisputably Wicker Man about Men was just the altar.
Right.
As far as I was concerned. And yeah, that gives it a little zhuzh, but like you say, it's enough to whet your appetite, and then, you know, all of a sudden you're left hungry.
Yes, right. It leaves you wanting more, and not in a good way. One pagan altar does not a Wicker Man make. When we reviewed the most recent Ben Wheatley movie, is it called In the Earth? I compared it or contrasted it. I liked it more than a movie he made called A Field in England. I think mm-hmm. I described Field in England as kind of being empty psychedelia, whereas In the Earth did a lot of the same stuff, but contextualized it in such a way that it felt more like an Altered States kind of movie, where there was just enough of a scientific pretext to make you drop your guard and actually accept what you were looking at and being presented with.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Field in England is just a barrage of kind of trippy, creepy visuals. In the Earth, it really just has different packaging, but it makes a big difference. That's how I feel vis-a-vis Men as opposed to Annihilation. I think that in Annihilation, you have those Altered States trappings that kind of sort of gesture in the direction of like, well, this is how this might actually happen if you just take this one sci-fi concept at face value. It's aliens. It's some kind of alien contaminant. And then you're off to the races. Here, it's much more avant-garde. There is no gesturing like that of any kind. You're completely left to form your own conclusions and kind of just take everything on the level of parable. It reminded me of Mother in that respect, mm-hmm. the Aronofsky movie.
I thought about Mother on at least one occasion.
That movie I'm also lukewarm on. I think, you know, it's not like I need this stuff spoon-fed to me, but if you give me some point of entry into the material that's a little bit more pedestrian, then you can go off in any crazy direction you want and I'll be along for the ride, rather than just making this total puzzle box that winds up being just kind of puzzling.
Yeah, there's nothing you can really latch onto on a story level, I guess. There's nothing really to conclude about what is happening in terms of the events. It's really just like the message is men are trash. And I'm being reductive, obviously, but that's really the whole thing here. You're taking the cultural and political messaging and figuring out exactly what nuances Garland's trying to impart to that. But yeah, in terms of what is going on to this character Harper in this weird place with these weird people who all look like Rory Kinnear, there's nothing to do.
Yeah, I just think, you know, at the end of the day, the emotional reality of the movie is that it's to do with, you know, I mean, to talk about reductive, there was a point some years ago where like the Babadook came out and you'd be like, I was like, it's too good to be true. It's this highbrow, scary horror movie that takes itself seriously. And get this, it's about grief. It's lofty. Now, if you tell me that like A24 has a horror movie out and it's about grief, like, I'm like, I've heard this song before. <It's>
like, when isn't it about grief?
Right, exactly.
I mean, we've had two Ari Aster movies about grief.
Right. I don't want to say that it's played its course, because these movies scratch such a particular itch for me, and I have been like a pig in shit the last several years, luxuriating in the A24 elevated horror renaissance. And I saw a tweet or a review somewhere that said that Men represents the tipping point where elevated horror becomes like a self-parody of itself. Though that was massively redundant.
Navel-gazing horror.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's you know, no longer elevated, I guess. It's crashed like Icarus, you know. And I'm not that down on Men, but I don't think that's an unreasonable tack to take. There's stuff in here that felt like Lars von Trier light a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. I talked about Antichrist as it pertains to the opening scene. There's also a shot of apples falling from a tree in the yard in slow motion, which could have come right out of...
Very Melancholia.
Yeah, Melancholia or Antichrist. I think in Antichrist, it's not pine cones. Something keeps... They sound like hailstones hitting the roof of the cabin in that movie. That's a recurring thing. The thing with the apples is overtly Edenic in a way that kind of bothered me. I mean, it's the first thing that she does when she shows up, and this feels like an Aronofskyan touch. You know, she sinks her teeth into a juicy red apple. This Eve figure who we've yet to even...
And wouldn't you know it, Jeffrey's making cracks about forbidden fruit.
Right.
Nothing to that. Forbidden fruit.
And then,
this was a joke.
Mercifully, yes, he then goes like, only kidding. And, you know, I feel like in
scrumping, mustn't do that.
Yeah,
that was the term, right? Scrumping?
Scrumping? I think so. Scalloping? No, ridiculous.
I think it was scrumping.
Yeah. And I feel like in Mother, that would not have been a joke. It would have been like Michelle Pfeiffer actually giving Jennifer Lawrence shit for eating apples.
Yeah.
So here, but even invoking it as a joke, you know, it's like, we got it. Men and women, Adam and Eve, where are we going with this? You know, and the answer is...
Nowhere in particular.
Nowhere in particular, yeah. it's a scary movie at points. You know, I mean, don't let anybody tell you it's not scary. And that's not nothing. I mean, I've lauded movies on this podcast that frankly freaked me out less than this one did. And it's not any of the theatrics at the end that really got a rise out of me. No. I mean, it was unexpected. But, you know, at that point, I was kind of checked out. It's more of the stuff in the first act, the stuff in the tunnel, some of the stuff with the naked man poking around. Alex Garland still knows how to make your skin crawl under the right circumstances. But I do think that when he gets into full-blown, non-narrative, kind of abstract horror show stuff at the end, he loses his way.
Yeah, the other thing that kind of bothers me about the apples all falling from the tree at once is that that's the only weird, broken, haunted physics thing that happens that, like, isn't directly connected to the Rorys. Obviously, the Rory birthing Rory is a much weirder physical phenomenon.
Uh-huh.
But again, that's directly connected to this weird, eldritch, multi-pronged abomination of men.
There's some weird stuff with dandelion seeds, but none of that stuff beggars belief quite as much as the tree shedding all of its apples at the same time.
Yeah, well, it's weird that there's, like, dandelion seeds floating around periodically, but that's still eminently terrestrial.
Yeah.
there's nothing intrinsically weird about a dandelion seed floating in the wind, because, you know, that's what they're designed to do. That's what they've evolved to do.
Right.
Whereas apple trees do not shed all of their apples in unison.
Right, like a dog shaking off rain after it comes indoors.
And
that's also the only payoff of the really on the nose Garden of Eden stuff right at the very beginning of the movie. Other than that, the apple tree never really comes back. It's just that one image, which, like I said, smacks of melancholia or antichrist, and just feels like it's like the folk horror stuff. It just feels a little thin, a little bit like cosplay.
Yeah, I mean,
like, I can see what you're aping, but I don't know how it's serving you.
If you want to have the trees and the surroundings doing weird shit, there's nothing that says you can't do that, but it's just weird that it is this one-off. It's just like the tree, one apple tree, sheds a bunch of apples, and then the physical properties of everything else are 100% normal, except for Rory's.
Yeah, I don't know. If the apple tree had gotten more attention, even if there had just been... There's a scene, and this I kind of liked, when she's first being given the tour by Jeffrey. He asks her if she can play the piano, and she says no. And then later on, when she's alone,
she definitely can.
Yeah, you see her tickling the ivories, and there's this kind of long montage devoted to just her playing the piano, and then shots of nature, trees and fields and so on. And I don't remember the apple tree factoring into that, but if the apple tree had just been given more weight outside of that one Eve moment right at the top, then maybe all of the apples falling down at once would have been like an oh shit moment, you know, and kind of, you know, in an incoherent, but like in an emotionally
visceral sort of
way, but it doesn't have that kind of weight. If anything, I remember a lot more dandelion imagery. Even over the closing credits, there's dandelion stuff happening, and I couldn't tell you why. I feel like you should probably just have one or the other.
It's Nature Man spreading his seed.
Yeah, I mean, but...
I guess.
I mean, you're probably right. And, you know, I love Invasion of the Body Snatchers. Anything with, like, spores floating on the breeze should be hitting me in my sweet spot, or one of my sweet spots, but I just thought it was confused.
Yeah.
I guess you go into a movie like this knowing or strongly suspecting that it's going to be a male writer-director kind of insisting, perhaps stridently, but you hope artfully, that they're on the right side of a particular culture war.
There was a tweet to that effect stumbled across. It was this movie, and then I don't remember what the other one was, but male directors insisting they're one of the good ones.
I think Last Night in Soho might have been the other one. Actually.
you're absolutely right.
And I would add Swallow to that list, frankly. In fact, I may have contributed to that exact thread. That might have been my contribution. Anyway, because of that, you know, going into this, that the twist, if there is one, is not just going to be, oh, she's crazy, because that would be horrific.
Yeah.
That would be very counterproductive for Alex Garland to just have her be Looney Tunes at the end of the day. She has to have her head on straight and... she has to probably triumph over the conspiracy, whatever it is. And so I think that helps him avert certain cliches, which is good. Like the fact that the naked guy doesn't just vanish when the cops show up. So there's some curveballs in there that I appreciate. However, your awareness that the movie has or is endeavoring to have good politics kind of takes away a certain amount of suspense, I think. I don't know exactly what I'm trying to say. I think that knowing that she's bound to be vindicated, and even if those politics are in line with your own, takes a certain amount of... It robs you of something, and I don't know exactly what, but you go into this wild-ass climax knowing that she's not going to wind up in a padded cell somewhere, you know, and that...
Well, yeah, I think it really is just as simple as you were starting out to say, which is it takes suspense out of it. Because at the end of the day, I don't want to say the character's not in danger, because there's still some level of danger, psychic danger, whatever.
And I said, but I like that she's not getting carved up, and I stand by that.
Right.
You know, because it's so novel.
Right.
It's unusual.
But nevertheless, there isn't that sense of ultimate danger of where she could end up dead, or end up, like you say, in the loony bin, or being sucked into a pocket dimension full of Rorys, or whatever. On the basis of the film's politics, as they're playing out, you're relatively confident, like, yeah, okay, she's gonna come out maybe a little bit psychically bruised, but overall vindicated and triumphant. That does let a little bit of air out of the thing.
Yeah, I mean, there's a weird lack of peril for how
perilous
wild
it
yeah,
is.
Right. It's, you know, I mean, Ex Machina, and certainly Annihilation, is just brimming with peril. You know, those movies feel more dangerous than this one does. And I think it is because you just figure that everything you're seeing, especially once the climax shifts into high gear, it's all just happening on some psychic battleground. It's purely operating on the level of metaphor after a certain point, and it ceases to be scary for that reason. It may hold your attention, as it mostly did mine, but it's hard to recommend it that enthusiastically. Even Mother, which I was lukewarm on, was like upsetting.
But yeah,
I got more involved in that movie than I did in this one, when all's said and done. Even, you know, it wasn't always a good emotional involvement half the time. I was just kind of I found it aggravating much of the time, but I was still getting worked up. And here, I don't know, seeing Rory Kinnear birth himself four times over ought to send you out of the theater going like, it ought to be more of a WTF moment than and maybe it's because I'm jaded. I'd heard tell of there being walkouts and people finding the ending of this movie like way too intense, and that was part of what drew me to it, that and me buying the folk horror thing hook, line, and sinker. But ultimately, it's hard to feel much of anything about it, unfortunately.
Yeah.
One, it's not a recommendation per se, but one movie that this reminded me of was Anomalisa, just because there's the running, I don't know if you'd call it a running joke or what, it's just kind of a feature of that movie that everyone except for the Lisa character and the main character, David Thewlis, is that who it is? Or somebody. He, the main character, every time another person opens their mouth, it's the same voice that comes out, whether it's a man, woman, child, whoever, it's all just this kind of bland male voice. You know, he gets into an argument with his girlfriend, and he just sounds like me. His girlfriend does, like, I can't believe you would do this to me. And I guess it's because he's just beyond depressed, and everything is this just gray melange to him, and nothing stands out or seems in any way special. And then he meets this one woman who is actually voiced by a different person. It's like this wrinkle in his life that you know, is the only new thing, the only thing that stands out. And I didn't go nuts for Anomalisa. I don't really remember huge chunks of it, but I liked that aspect of it. I thought that was kind of a cute way of depicting a character being numb to the world and nothing breaking through his shell until that one unique voice slips through a crack somewhere. I was reminded of that, of course, because we're living in a pocket dimension of Rory's here, where every face that she meets is the same face. Now, in Anomalisa, I was able to deduce, I think, why the filmmakers were doing that. Here, I'm not entirely sure, other than giving Rory Kinnear the chance to strut his stuff, which is very entertaining for the most part. I don't know, you know, if like the dead husband had also been played by Rory Kinnear, then it would have been very cut and dry, arguably too cut and dry, you know.
Yeah, that's I kept wrestling with that possibility, like, do I wish Rory Kinnear had been her husband? And yeah, I mean, exactly like you say.
Yeah,
that would have there would have been a clearer through line there, but then it's just sort of pat.
Right.
It's like, I have to fight my way through all of these versions of my husband so I can come to grips with the ghost of the real thing and then put him to bed.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been, I think I might take Pat over excessively cryptic, but there has to be a happy middle ground in there somewhere, and mm-hmm. I don't know. I think, obviously, if she were seeing her dead husband's face everywhere she looks, it would make the grief angle much more aggressive. She'd be projecting his face onto every man that she meets, maybe because his suicide traumatized her, maybe because the relationship itself was traumatic. He took a swing at her at least once that were shown.
I think it's supposed to be just the once. She says as much to the vicar before he has his heel turn, and I don't think she would be lying.
No, I suspect not. So jury's out on that one. Point being, at least Anomalisa had a discernible motive for doing what it did. And I'm not sorry that men cast Rory Kinnear in every male role, because it's something I haven't seen before. However, it does lack a certain through line, I think was the word you used. So check out Anomalisa, maybe, if you want an example of that sort of thing being done with a somewhat clearer MO. And then the horror movie that I'm going to recommend, mainly because I feel like we've recommended Repulsion before. I'm casting my mind about for other movies of that ilk that are about women navigating tense social situations involving men where there's maybe some kind of psychosexual trauma at play under the surface. And what came to mind was Carnival of Souls,
okay,
which is
sure.
From a few years before Repulsion. And the main reason I'm recommending it, I mean, there is a male character in that movie who really leans on her and badgers her and is kind of a bore and is really just trying to wear down her resistance and
sex pest.
Get her to sleep with him. Yeah, exactly. And is a real nuisance and a real menace. And that element of the movie of is reminiscent of certain parts of Men and is kind of what you expect to see when you buy a ticket for a movie that's just called Men, you know, a horror movie, would be a lot more stuff like that. And I said before that Alex Garland throws some curveballs at you. I think one of the curveballs is Jeffrey not ever being a sex pest and most of the men not being just one dimensional. You know, I mean, they're all, it's not like they're all like richly characterized, you know, but they're only the priest really.
Most of them are not walking dicks.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So Carnival of Souls is really ahead of the curve on that stuff. And the other reason that I am recommending it is because it all does hinge on a twist that has a great impact, less so nowadays because it's been done over and over again. I still won't spoil it. But, you know, the twist is really readily understood and it's kind of airtight in a way. In that sense, it's the exact opposite of Men, which is, I'm hard-pressed to think of a movie I've seen in theaters, at least, lately, that was more open-ended or more open to interpretation, which are both laudable qualities in theory.
Up to a point.
Yeah, right. And, you know, execution is everything. So if you were to watch Men and you were left hungering for a movie that traffics in some of the same scares but has a much tidier and honestly more frightening, for my money, resolution, then Carnival of Souls is the way to go. Carnival of Souls has no folk horror elements, so you'll have to get those kicks elsewhere. But it doesn't purport to have any, so another point in its favor, I guess.
Right. Well, I think I'm just going to have to take a mulligan on this one. I've been racking my brain trying to find an apropos recommendation for this particular film, and I'm just coming up empty. Obviously, we've compared it to other Alex Garland films, and there are plenty of parallels on that score, but sort of branching out beyond his filmography, it's difficult to find movies that do some of the sorts of things that Men is doing that I also actually liked.
Right.
Like, we talked about several minutes ago, Last Night in Soho tries to do similar male director, I get it, guys, messaging. But number one, we did an episode on that already. Number two, it wasn't very good.
More pertinently, yeah, we both wound up hating its guts a little bit.
So that's no good. Yeah, I would, I think, as we've gotten across, I would recommend Annihilation and Ex Machina, which do many of the things that this film does, and as Matt said, do them better. I also, some of the nature stuff called back to Stalker for me.
Sure.
Which is unsurprising because Annihilation is even more overtly Stalker-esque.
Yeah. Annihilation is like John Carpenter's Stalker.
Yeah, right. So it's unsurprising that Alex Garland's next project still has echoes of that running through it. And obviously Stalker is a landmark film. So I'm not exactly lifting up rocks to find obscure films or anything. But those are all worth checking out. Carnival of Souls, as Matt said, also quite good. So I will sort of half-heartedly piggyback on that.
By all means.
Yeah. As for my own sui generis recommendation, I am taking a mulligan this time around. So that's where we'll leave things. We'll put the nesting Rorys back inside one another and...
you have to put your nesting Rorys away when you're done playing with them. You can't just leave them scattered across the floor. They hurt worse than Lego bricks if you step on them.
You get impaled by a crab arm.
Mm-hmm.
But until next time, I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we are the Shock Doctors. We'll see you later.
As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Men Official Trailer HD A24, uploaded by A24. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, June 19th, and we will be discussing David Cronenberg's controversial new film, Crimes of the Future. See you then.